pressed Matthew's body into mine, encouraging him to drink more deeply. His relish when he did so was evident, how he'd hungered for me, and how strong he'd been to resist. Matthew settled into the rhythms of his feeding, pulling on my blood in waves. "Matthew, listen to me." Thanks to Gerbert, I knew that my blood would carry messages to him. My only worry was that they would be fleeting, and my power to communicate would be swallowed up. He startled against my throat, then resumed his feeding. "I love you." He gave another start of surprise. "This was my gift. I'm inside you, giving you life." Matthew shook his head as if to dislodge an annoying insect and kept drinking. "I am inside you, giving you life." It was harder to think, harder to see through the fire. I focused on Em and Sarah, tried to tell them with my eyes not to worry. I looked for Marcus, too, but couldn't move my eyes enough to find him. "I am inside you, giving you life." I repeated the mantra until it was no longer possible. There was a slow pulsing, the sound of my heart starting to die. Dying was nothing at all like I'd expected it to be. There was a moment of bone-deep quiet, a sense of parting and regret, then nothing. Chapter 38. In my bones there was a sudden boom, as of two worlds colliding. Something stung my right arm, accompanied by the odor of latex and plastic, and Matthew was arguing with Marcus. There was cold earth below me, and the tang of leaf mold replaced the other scents. My eyes were open, but I saw nothing except blackness. With effort, I was able to pick out the half-bare branches of trees crisscrossing above me.
"Use the left arm, it's already open," said Matthew with impatience.
"That arm's useless, Matthew. The tissues are full of your saliva and won't absorb anything else. The right arm is better. The blood pressure is so low I'm having a hard time finding a vein, that's all."
Marcus's voice had the unnatural quietness of the emergency room physician who sees death regularly. Two thick strands of spaghetti spooled onto my face. Cold fingers touched my nose and I tried to shake them off, only to be held down. Miriam's voice came from the darkness to my right.
"Tachycardia. I'll sedate her."
"No," Matthew said roughly. "No sedatives. She's barely conscious. They could put her into a coma."
"Then keep her quiet."
Miriam's tone was matter of fact. Tiny, cold fingers pressed against my neck with unexpected firmness.
"I can't stop her from bleeding out and hold her still at the same time."
What was happening around me was visible only in disconcerting slices. What was directly above, what could be glimpsed from the corners of my eyes, and what could be tracked through the enormous effort of swiveling them in their sockets.
"Can you do anything, Sarah?"
Matthew's voice was anguished. Sarah's face swam into view. "Witchcraft can't heal vampire bites. If it could, we'd never have anything to fear from creatures like you." I began drifting to somewhere peaceful, but my progress was interrupted by Em's slipping her hand into mine, holding me firmly in my own body.
"We've got no choice, then." Matthew sounded desperate. "I'll do it."
"No, Matthew," said Miriam decidedly. "You're not strong enough yet. Besides, I've done it hundreds of times."
There was a tearing sound. After Juliet's attack on Matthew, I recognized that it was vampire flesh.
"Are they making me a vampire?"
I whispered to Em.
"No, mon coeur."
Matthew's voice was as decided as Miriam's had been.
"You lost. I took a great deal of blood. Marcus is replacing it with human blood. Now Miriam needs to see to your neck."
"Oh." It was too complicated to follow. My brain was fuzzy, almost as fuzzy as my tongue and throat.
"I'm thirsty."
"You're craving vampire blood, but you're not going to get it. Lie very still," Matthew said firmly, holding my shoulders so tightly it was painful.
Marcus's cold hands crept past my ears to my jaw, holding my mouth closed too. "And Miriam..."
"Stop fussing, Matthew," Miriam said briskly. "I was doing this to warm bloods long before you were reborn."
Something sharp cut into my neck, and the smell of blood filled the air. The cutting sensation was followed by a pain that froze and burned simultaneously. The heat and cold intensified, traveling below the surface tissues of my neck to sear the bones and muscles underneath. I wanted to escape the icy licks, but there were two vampires holding me down. My mouth was firmly closed, too, so all I could do was let out a muffled, fearful sound.
"Her artery is obscured," Miriam said quietly. "The wound has to be cleared."
She took a single, audible sip, drawing the blood away. The skin was numbed momentarily, but sensation returned full force when she withdrew. The extreme pain sent adrenaline coursing through my system, and panic followed in its wake. The gray walls of La Pierre loomed around me, my inability to move putting me back within Satu's hands. Matthew's fingers dug into my shoulders, returning me to the woods outside the Bishop House.
"Tell her what you're doing, Miriam. That Finnish witch made her afraid of what she can't see."
"It's just drops of my blood, Diana, falling from my wrist," Miriam said calmly. "I know it hurts, but it's all we have. Vampire blood heals on contact. It will close your artery better than the sutures a surgeon would use. And you needn't worry. There's no chance such a small amount applied topically will make you one of us."
After her description, it was possible to recognize each deliberate drop falling into my open wound. There, it mingled with my witch's flesh, forcing an instantaneous buildup of scar tissue. It must require enormous control, I thought, for a vampire to undertake such a procedure without giving in to hunger. At last, the drops of searing coldness came to an end.
"Done," Miriam said with a touch of relief. "All I have to do now is sew the incision."
Her fingers flew over my neck, tugging and stitching the flesh back together.
"I tried to neaten the wound, Diana, but Matthew tore the skin with his teeth."
"We're going to move you to the house now," Matthew said.
He cradled my head and shoulders while Marcus supported my legs. Miriam walked alongside, carrying the equipment. Someone had driven the Range Rover across the fields, and it stood waiting with its rear door open. Matthew and Miriam switched places, and he disappeared into the cargo area to ready it for me.
"Miriam?"
I whispered. She bent toward me.
"If something goes wrong..."
I couldn't finish, but it was imperative she understand me. I was still a witch, but I'd rather be a vampire than dead. She stared into my eyes, searched for a moment, then nodded.
"Don't you dare die, though. He'll kill me if I do what you ask."
Matthew talked non-stop during the bumpy ride back to the house, kissing me softly whenever I tried to sleep. Despite his gentleness, it was a wrench each time. At the house, Sarah and Em sped around, collecting cushions and pillows. They made a bed in front of the keeping room's fireplace. Sarah lit the pile of logs in the grate with a few words and a gesture. A blaze began to burn, but I still shivered uncontrollably, cold to the core. Matthew lowered me onto the cushions and covered me with quilts, while Miriam pressed a bandage onto my neck. As she worked, my husband and his son muttered in the corner.
"It's what she needs, and I do know where her lungs are," Marcus said impatiently. "I won't puncture anything." "She's strong. No central line, end of discussion. Just get rid of what's left of Juliet's body," Matthew said, his voice quiet but commanding.
"I'll see to it," Marcus replied.
He turned on his heel, and the front door thudded behind him before the Range Rover sprang once more into life. The ancient case clock in the front entrance ticked the minutes as they passed. The warmth soaked into my bones, making me drowsy. Matthew sat at my side, holding one hand tightly so that he could tug me back whenever I tried to escape into the welcome oblivion. Finally, Miriam said the magic word, "stable." Then I could give in to the blackness flitting around the edges of my consciousness. Sarah and Em kissed me and left. Miriam followed, and at last there was nothing but Matthew and the blessed quiet. Once the silence descended, however, my mind turned to Juliet.
"I killed her."
My heart raced.
"You had no choice."
His tone said no further discussion was required. It was self-defense.
"No, it wasn't. The witch fire..."
It was only when he was in danger that the bow and arrow had appeared in my hands. Matthew quieted me with a kiss. "We can talk about that tomorrow." There was something that couldn't wait.
Something I wanted him to know now.
I love you, Matthew.
There hadn't been a chance to tell him before Satu snatched me away from Settor. This time, I wanted to be sure it was said before something else happened.
I love you too.
He bent his head, his lips against my ear.
Remember our dinner in Oxford? You wanted to know how you would taste.
I moved my head in acknowledgement.
You taste of honey, he murmured.
Honey and hope. My lips curved, and then I slept. But it was not a restful slumber. I was caught between waking and sleeping, LaPierre and Madison, life and death. The ghostly old woman had warned me of the danger of standing at a crossroads. There were times that death seemed to be standing patiently at my side, waiting for me to choose the road I wanted to take. I traveled countless miles that night, fleeing from place to place, never more than a step ahead of whoever was pursuing me, Gerbert, Satu, Juliette, Peter Knox. Whenever my journey brought me back to the Bishop House, Matthew was there. Sometimes Sarah was with him. Other times it was Marcus. Most often, though, Matthew was alone. Deep in the night, someone started humming the tune we'd danced to a lifetime ago in Isabeau's Grand Salon. It wasn't Marcus or Matthew. They were talking to each other, but I was too tired to figure out where the music was coming from.
Where did she learn that old song? Marcus asked.
At home. Christ, even in sleep she's trying to be brave.
Matthew's voice was desolate.
Baldwin is right. I'm no good at strategy. I should have foreseen this.
Gerbert counted on your forgetting about Juliet. It had been so long, and he knew you'd be with Diana when she struck. He gloated about it on the phone.
Yes, he knows I'm arrogant enough to think she was safe with me at her side.
You've tried to protect her, but you can't. No one could. She's not the only one who needs to stop being brave.
There was something Marcus didn't know, something Matthew was forgetting. Snatches of half-remembered conversation came back to me. The music stopped to let me speak.
I told you before, I said,
groping for Matthew in the dark and finding only a handful of soft wool that released the scent of cloves when crushed.
I can be brave enough for both of us.
Diana, Matthew said urgently, open your eyes and look at me.
His face was inches from mine. He was cradling my head with one hand, the other cool on my lower back, where a crescent moon swept from one side of my body to the other.
There you are, I murmured. I'm afraid we're lost.
No, my darling, we're not lost. We're at the Bishop House, and you don't need to be brave. It's my turn.
Will you be able to figure out which road we need to take?
I'll find the way. Rest, and let me take care of that.
Matthew's eyes were very green. I drifted off once more, racing to elude Gerbert and Juliet, who were hard at my heels. Toward dawn, my sleep deepened, and when I awoke, it was morning. A quick check revealed that my body was naked and tucked tightly under layers of quilts, like a patient in a British intensive care ward. Tubing disappeared into my right arm, a bandage encased my left elbow, and something was stuck to my neck. Matthew was sitting nearby, with knees bent and his back against the sofa.
Matthew, is everyone all right?
There was cotton wool wrapped around my tongue, and I was still fiercely thirsty.
Everyone's fine.
Relief washed over his face as he reached for my hand and pressed his lips to my palm. Matthew's eyes flickered to my wrist, where Juliet's fingernails had left angry red crescent moons. The sound of our voices brought the rest of the household into the room. First, there were my aunts. Sarah was lost in her thoughts, dark hollows under her eyes. Em looked tired but relieved, stroking my hair and assuring me that everything was going to be all right. Marcus came next. He examined me and talked sternly about my need to rest. Finally, Miriam ordered everyone else out of the room so she could change my bandages.
How bad was it? I asked, when we were alone. If you mean Matthew, it was bad. The de Clermonts don't handle loss or the threat of it very well. Isabeau was worse when Philippe died. It's a good thing you lived, not just for my sake.
Miriam applied ointment to my wounds with a surprisingly delicate touch. Her words conjured images of Matthew on a vengeful rampage. I closed my eyes to blot them out.
Tell me about Juliet.
Miriam emitted a low hiss of warning.
Juliet Durand is not my tale to tell. Ask your husband.
She disconnected the IV and held out one of Sarah's old flannel shirts. After I struggled with it for a few moments, she came to my aid. Her eyes fell on the marks on my back. The scars don't bother me. They're just signs that I've fought and survived. I pulled the shirt over my shoulders self-consciously nonetheless.
They don't bother him either. Loving de Clermont's always leaves a mark. Nobody knows that better than Matthew.
I buttoned up the shirt with shaking fingers, unwilling to meet her eyes. She handed over a pair of stretchy black leggings.
Giving him your blood like that was unspeakably dangerous. He might not have been able to stop drinking.
A note of admiration had crept into her voice.
Isabeau told me the de Clermonts fight for those they love.
His mother will understand, but Matthew is another matter. He needs to get it out of his system. Your blood, what happened last night, everything.
Juliet. The name hung unspoken in the air between us. Miriam reconnected the IV and adjusted its flow.
Marcus will take him to Canada. It will be hours before Matthew finds someone he's willing to feed on, but it can't be helped.
Sarah and Dan will be safe with both of them gone?
You bought us some time. The congregation never imagined that Juliet would fail. Gerbert is as proud as Matthew and nearly as infallible. It will take them a few days to regroup.
She froze, a guilty look on her face.
I'd like to talk to Diana now, Matthew said quietly from the door.
He looked terrible. There was hunger in the sharpened angles of his face and the lavender smudges under his eyes. He watched silently as Miriam walked around my makeshift bed. She shut the heavy coffin doors behind her, their catches clicking together. When he turned to me, his look was concerned. Matthew's need for blood was at war with his protective instincts.
"When are you leaving?"
I asked, hoping to make my wishes clear.
"I'm not leaving."
"You need to regain your strength. Next time the congregation won't send just one vampire or witch."
I wondered how many other creatures from Matthew's past were likely to come calling at the congregation's behest, and I struggled to sit up.
You are so experienced with war now, Marleon, that you understand their strategies?
It was impossible to judge his feelings from his features, but his voice betrayed a hint of amusement.
We proved we can't be beaten easily.
Easily? You almost died.
He sat next to me on the cushions.
So did you.
You used your magic to save me. I could smell it.
Lady's mantle and ambergris. It was nothing.
I didn't want him to know what I'd promised in exchange for his life.
No lies.
Matthew grabbed my chin with his fingertips.
If you don't want to tell me, say so. Your secrets are your own, but no lies.
If I do keep secrets, I won't be the only one doing so in this family. Tell me about Juliet Durand.
He let go of my chin and moved restlessly to the window.
You know that Gerbert introduced us. He kidnapped her from a Cairo brothel, brought her to the brink of death over and over again before transforming her into a vampire, and then shaped her into someone I would find appealing. I still don't know if she was insane when Gerbert found her or if her mind broke after what he did to her.
Why?
I couldn't keep the incredulity from my voice.
She was meant to worm her way into my heart, and then into my family's affairs. Gerbert had always wanted to be included among the Knights of Lazarus, and my father refused him time and time again. Once Juliet had discovered the intricacies of the Brotherhood, and any other useful information about the de Clermonts, she was free to kill me. Gerbert trained her to be my assassin, as well as my lover.
Matthew picked at the window frame's peeling paint. When I first met her, she was better at hiding her illness. It took me a long time to see the signs. Baldwin and Isabeau never trusted her, and Marcus detested her. But I...
Gerbert taught her well. She reminded me of Louisa, and her emotional fragility seemed to explain her erratic behavior.
He has always liked fragile things, Isabeau had warned me. Matthew hadn't been just sexually attracted to Juliet. The feelings had gone deeper.
You did love her.
I remembered Juliet's strange kiss and shuddered.
Once. Long ago. For all the wrong reasons, Matthew continued. I watched her from a safe distance and made sure she was cared for since she was incapable of caring for herself. When World War I broke out, she disappeared and I assumed she'd been killed. I never imagined she was alive somewhere.
And all the time you were watching her, she was watching you too.
Juliet's attentive eyes had taken in my every movement. She must have observed Matthew with a similar keenness.
If I'd known, she would never have been allowed to get near you.
He stared out into the pale morning light. But there's something else we have to discuss.
You must promise me never to use your magic to save me. I've no wish to live longer than I meant to. Life and death are powerful forces. Isabeau interfered with them on my behalf once. You aren't to do it again. And no asking Miriam or anyone else to make you a vampire.
His voice was startling in its coldness, and he crossed the room to my side with quick, long strides.
No one, not even I, will transform you into something you're not.
You'll have to promise me something in return. His eyes narrowed with displeasure.
What's that?
Don't ever ask me to leave you when you're in danger, I said fiercely. I won't do it. Matthew calculated what would be required of him to keep his promise while keeping me out of harm's way. I was just as busy figuring out which of my dimly understood powers needed mastering so that I could protect him without incinerating him or drowning myself. We eyed each other warily for a few moments. Finally, I touched his cheek.
Go hunting with Marcus. We'll be fine for a few hours.
His color was all wrong. I wasn't the only one who had lost a lot of blood.
You shouldn't be alone.
I have my aunts, not to mention Miriam. She told me at the Bodleian that her teeth are as sharp as yours. I believe her. I was more knowledgeable now about vampire teeth.
We'll be home by dark, he said reluctantly, brushing his fingers across my cheekbone. Is there anything you need before I go?
I'd like to talk to Isabeau.
Sarah had been distant that morning, and I wanted to hear a maternal voice.
Of course, he said, hiding his surprise by reaching into his pocket for his phone.
Someone had taken the time to retrieve it from the bushes. He dialed Settur with the push of his finger.
Maman?
A torrent of French erupted from the phone. She's fine, Matthew interrupted, his voice soothing. Diana wants... she's asked to speak to you.
There was silence, followed by a single, crisp word. Oui?
Matthew handed me the phone.
Isabeau?
My voice cracked, my eyes filled with sudden tears.
I am here, Diana.
Isabeau sounded as musical as ever.
I almost lost him.
You should have obeyed him and gone as far away from Juliet as you could.
Isabeau's tone was sharp before turning soft once more.
But I'm glad you did not.
I cried in earnest then. Matthew stroked the hair back from my forehead, tucking my typically wayward strand behind my ear before leaving me to my conversation.
To Isabeau, I was able to express my grief and to confess my failure to kill Juliet at my first opportunity. I told her everything, about Juliet's startling appearance and her strange kiss, my terror when Matthew began to feed, about what it was like to begin to die, only to return abruptly to life. Matthew's mother understood, as I'd known she would. The only time Isabeau interrupted was during the part of my story that involved the maiden and the crone.
So the goddess saved my son, she murmured. She has a sense of justice as well as humor. But that is too long a tale for today. When you're next at Settur, I will tell you.
Her mention of the chateau caused another sharp pang of homesickness.
I wish I were there. I'm not sure anyone in Madison can teach me all that I need to know.
Then we must find a different teacher. Somewhere there is a creature who can help.
Isabeau issued a series of firm instructions about obeying Matthew, taking care of him, taking care of myself, and returning to the chateau as soon as possible. I agreed to all of them with uncharacteristic alacrity and got off the phone. A few tactful moments later, Matthew opened the door and stepped inside. "Thank you," I said, sniffing and holding up his phone. He shook his head. "Keep it. Call Marcus or Isabeau at any time. The number's 2 and 3 on speed dial. You need a new phone, as well as a watch. Yours doesn't even hold a charge." Matthew settled me gently against the cushions and kissed my forehead. "Miriam's working in the dining room, but she'll hear the slightest sound." "Sarah and Em?" I asked. "Waiting to see you," he said with a smile. After visiting with my aunts, I slept a few hours, until a restless yearning for Matthew had me clawing myself awake. Em got up from my grandmother's recently returned rocker and came to me carrying a glass of water, her forehead creased in deep lines that hadn't been there a few days ago. Grandma was sitting on the sofa, staring at the paneling next to the fireplace, clearly waiting for another message from the house. "Where's Sarah?" I closed my fingers around the glass. My throat was still parched, and the water would feel divine. "She went out for a while." Em's delicate mouth pressed into a thin line. "She blames this all on Matthew." Em dropped down to her knees on the floor until her eyes were level with mine. "This has nothing to do with Matthew. You offered your blood to a vampire, a desperate, dying vampire." She silenced my protests with a look. "I know he's not just any vampire. Even so, Matthew could kill you. And Sarah's devastated that she can't teach you how to control your talents." "Sarah shouldn't worry about me. Did you see what I did to Juliet?" She nodded. "And other things as well." My grandmother's attention was now fixed on me instead of the paneling. "I saw the hunger in Matthew when he fed on you," Em continued quietly. "I saw the maiden and the crone, too, standing on the other side of the fire." "Did Sarah see them?" I whispered, hoping that Miriam couldn't hear. Em shook her head. "No. Does Matthew know?" "No." I pushed my hair aside, relieved that Sarah was unaware of all that had happened last night. "What did you promise the goddess in exchange for his life, Diana?" "Anything she wanted." "Oh, honey." Em's face crumpled. "You shouldn't have done that. There's no telling when she'll act, or what she'll take." My grandmother was furiously rocking. Em eyed the chair's wild movements. "I had to, Em. The goddess didn't seem surprised. It felt inevitable. Right, somehow." "Have you seen the maiden and the crone before?" I nodded. "The maiden's been in my dreams. Sometimes it's as though I'm inside her, looking out as she rides or hunts, and the crone met me outside the keeping room." "You're in deep water now, Diana," my grandmother rustled. "I hope you can swim." "You mustn't call the goddess lightly," Em warned. "These are powerful forces that you don't yet understand." "I didn't call her at all. They appeared when I decided to give Matthew my blood. They gave me their help willingly."
"Maybe it wasn't your blood to give."
My grandmother continued to rock back and forth, setting the floorboards creaking. "Did you ever think of that?"
"You've known Matthew for a few weeks, yet you follow his orders so easily and you were willing to die for him. Surely you can see why Sarah is concerned. The Diana we've known all these years is gone."
"I love him," I said fiercely, "and he loves me." Matthew's many secrets, the Knights of Lazarus, Juliet, even Marcus, I pushed to the side, along with my knowledge of his ferocious temper and his need to control everything and everyone around him. But Em knew what I was thinking. She shook her head.
"You can't ignore them, Diana. You tried that with your magic and it found you. The parts of Matthew you don't like and don't understand are going to find you too. You can't hide forever, especially now."
"What do you mean?"
"There are too many creatures interested in this manuscript, and in you and Matthew. I can feel them pressing in on the Bishop House, on you. I don't know which side of this struggle they're on,
but my sixth sense tells me it won't be long before we find out.
M tucked the quilt around me. After putting another log on the fire, she left the room. I was awakened by my husband's distinctive spicy scent.
"You're back," I said, rubbing my eyes. Matthew looked rested, and his skin had returned to its normal, pearly color.
He'd fed on human blood.
"So are you."
Matthew brought my hand to his lips.
"Miriam said you've been sleeping for most of the day."
"Is Sarah home?"
"Everyone's present and accounted for." He gave me a lopsided grin, even Tabitha.
I asked to see them, and he unhooked me from my IV without argument. When my legs were too unsteady to carry me to the family room, he simply swept me up and carried me.
Em and Marcus settled me into the sofa with great ceremony. I was quickly exhausted by nothing more strenuous than quiet conversation and watching the latest film noir selection on TV, and Matthew lifted me up once more.
"We're going upstairs," he announced. "We'll see you in the morning."
"Do you want me to bring up Diana's IV?" Miriam asked pointedly.
"No, she doesn't need it." His voice was brusque.
"Thank you for not hooking me up to all that stuff," I said as he carried me through the front hall.
"Your body is still weak, but it's remarkably resilient for a warm blood," Matthew said as he climbed the stairs. "The reward for being a perpetual motion machine, I imagine."
Once he'd turned off the light, I curled into his body with a contented sigh, my fingers splayed possessively across his chest. The moonlight streaming through the windows highlighted his new scars. They were already fading from pink to white. Tired as I was, the gears of Matthew's mind were working so furiously that sleep proved impossible. It was plain from the set of his mouth and the bright glitter of his eyes that he was picking our road forward, just as he'd promised to do last night.
"Tell me," I said when the suspense became unbearable.
"What we need is time," he said thoughtfully.
"The congregation isn't likely to give us that."
"We'll take it, then."
His voice was almost inaudible.
"We'll time walk."
Chapter 39. We made it only halfway down the stairs the next morning before stopping to rest, but I was determined to get to the kitchen under my own steam. To my surprise, Matthew didn't try to dissuade me. We sat on the worn wooden treads in companionable silence. Pale, watery light seeped in through the wavy glass panes around the front door, hinting at a sunny day to come. From the family room came the click of Scrabble tiles. "When will you tell them?"
There wasn't much to divulge yet. He was still working on the basic outlines of the plan.
"Later," he said, leaning into me. I leaned toward him, pressing our shoulders closer.
"No amount of coffee is going to keep Sarah from freaking out when she hears." I put my hand on the banister and levered myself to my feet with a sigh. "Let's try this again." In the family room, M brought me my first cup of tea. I sipped it on the couch while Matthew and Marcus headed off for their walk with my silent blessing. They should spend as much time as possible together before we left. After my tea, Sarah made me her famous scrambled eggs. They were laden with onions, mushrooms, and cheese, and topped with a spoonful of salsa. She put a steaming plate before me.
"Thanks, Sarah."
I dove in without further ceremony. "It's not just Matthew who needs food and rest." She glanced out the window to the orchard where the two vampires were walking.
"I feel much better today," I said, crunching a bite of toast.
"Your appetite seems to have recovered, at least." There was already a sizable dent in the mountain of eggs.
When Matthew and Marcus returned, I was on my second plate of food. They both appeared grim, but Matthew shook his head at my curious look. Apparently, they hadn't been talking about our plans to time walk. Something else had put them into a sour mood. Matthew pulled up a stool, flapped open the paper, and concentrated on the news. I ate my eggs and toast, made more tea, and bided my time while Sarah washed and put away the dishes. At last, Matthew folded his paper and set it aside.
"I'd like to go to the woods, to where Juliet died," I announced.
He got to his feet. "I'll pull the Range Rover to the door."
"This is madness, Matthew. It's too soon."
Marcus turned to Sarah for support.
"Let them go," Sarah said. Diana should put on warmer clothes first, though. It's chilly outside.
Em appeared, a puzzled expression on her face.
Are we expecting visitors? The house thinks we are.
You're joking, I said.
The house hasn't added a room since the last family reunion. Where is it? Between the bathroom and the junk room.
Em pointed at the ceiling.
I told you this wasn't just about you and Matthew, she said silently to me as we trooped upstairs to view the transformation. My premonitions are seldom wrong.
The newly materialized room held an ancient brass bed with enormous polished balls capping each corner, tatty red gingham curtains that Em insisted were coming down immediately, a hooked rug in clashing shades of maroon and plum, and a battered washstand with a chipped pink bowl and pitcher. None of us recognized a single item.
Where did it all come from? Miriam asked in amazement.
Who knows where the house keeps this stuff? Sarah sat on the bed and bounced on it vigorously. It responded with a series of outraged squeaks.
The house's most legendary feats happened around my 13th birthday, I remembered with a grin. It came up with a record 4 bedrooms and a Victorian parlor set.
And 24 place settings of blue willow china, Em recalled. We've still got some of the teacups, although most of the bigger pieces disappeared again once the family left.
After everybody had inspected the new room and the now considerably smaller storage room next door, I changed and made my halting way downstairs and into the Range Rover. When we drew close to the spot where Juliet had met her end, Matthew stopped. The heavy tires sank into the soft ground. "Shall we walk the rest of the way?" he suggested. "We can take it slowly." He was different this morning. He wasn't coddling me or telling me what to do.
"What's changed?"
I asked as we approached the ancient oak tree. "I've seen you fight," he said quietly. "On the battlefield, the bravest men collapse in fear. They simply can't fight, even to save themselves."
But I froze.
My hair tumbled forward to conceal my face. Matthew stopped in his tracks, his fingers tightening on my arm to make me stop too.
"Of course you did. You were about to take a life, but you don't fear death."
"No."
"I'd lived with death, sometimes longed for it, since I was 7.
He swung me around to face him. "After La Pierre, Sartu left you broken and uncertain. All your life you've hidden from your fears. I wasn't sure you'd be able to fight if you had to. Now all I have to do is keep you from taking unnecessary risks." His eyes drifted to my neck. Matthew moved forward, towing me gently along. A smudge of blackened grass told me we'd arrived at the clearing. I stiffened, and he released my arm. The marks left by the fire led to the dead patch where Juliet had fallen. The forest was eerily quiet, without bird calls or other sounds of life. I gathered a bit of charred wood from the ground. It crumbled to soot in my fingers. I didn't know Juliet, but at that moment I hated her enough to kill her. Her brown and green eyes would always haunt me from shadows under the trees. I traced the line left by the arc of conjured fire to where the maiden and the crone had agreed to help me save Matthew. I looked up into the oak tree and gasped. "It began yesterday." Matthew followed my gaze. "Sarah says you pulled the life out of it." Above me, the branches of the tree were cracked and withered. Bare limbs forked and forked again into shapes reminiscent of a stag's horns. Brown leaves swirled at my feet. Matthew had survived because I'd pushed its vitality through my veins and into his body. The oak's rough bark had exuded such permanence, yet there was nothing now but hollowness.
"Power always exacts a price," Matthew said.
"What have I done?"
The death of a tree was not going to settle my debt to the goddess. For the first time, I was afraid of the deal I'd struck. Matthew crossed the clearing and caught me up in his arms. We hugged each other, fierce with the knowledge of all we'd almost lost. "You promised me you would be less reckless." There was anger in his voice.
I was angry with him, too. You were supposed to be indestructible.
He rested his forehead against mine.
"I should have told you about Juliet."
"Yes, you should have. She almost took you from me."
My pulse throbbed behind the bandage on my neck. Matthew's thumb settled against the spot where he'd bitten through flesh and muscle, his touch unexpectedly warm.
"It was far too close.
His fingers were wrapped in my hair and his mouth was hard on mine. Then we stood, hearts pressed together, in the quiet. When I took Juliet's life, it made her part of mine, forever. Matthew stroked my hair against my skull. Death is its own powerful magic. Calm again, I said a silent word of thanks to the goddess, not only for Matthew's life, but for my own. We walked toward the Range Rover, but halfway there I stumbled with fatigue. Matthew swung me onto his back and carried me the rest of the way. Sarah was bent over her desk in the office when we arrived at the house. She flew outside and pulled open the car door with speed a vampire might envy. "Damn it, Matthew," she said, looking at my exhausted face. Together they got me inside and back onto the family room couch, where I rested my head in Matthew's lap. I was lulled to sleep by the quiet sounds of activity all around, and the last thing I remembered clearly was the smell of vanilla and the sound of Em's battered KitchenAid mixer. Matthew woke me for lunch, which turned out to be vegetable soup. The look on his face suggested that I would shortly need sustenance. He was about to tell our families of the plan. "Ready, mon coeur?" Matthew asked. I nodded, scraping up the last of my meal. Marcus's head swiveled in our direction. "We have something to share with you," he announced. The new household tradition was to proceed to the dining room whenever something important needed to be discussed. Once we were assembled, all eyes turned to Matthew. "What have you decided?" Marcus asked without preamble. Matthew took a deliberate breath and began. "We need to go where it won't be easy for the congregation to follow, where Diana will have time and teachers who can help her master her magic." Sarah laughed under her breath. "Where is this place, where there are powerful, patient witches who don't mind having a vampire hanging around?" "It's not a particular place I have in mind," Matthew said cryptically. "We're going to hide Diana in time." Everyone started shouting at once. Matthew took my hand in his. "Courage," I murmured in French, repeating his advice when I met Isabeau. He snorted and gave me a grim smile. I had some sympathy for their amazed disbelief. Last night, while I was lying in bed, my own reaction had been much the same. First, I'd insisted that it was impossible, and then I'd asked for 1,000 details about precisely when and where we were going. He'd explained what he could, which wasn't much. "You want to use your magic, but now it's using you. You need a teacher, one who is more adept than Sarah or Emily. It's not their fault they can't help you. Witches in the past were different. So much of their knowledge has been lost." "Where? When?" I'd whispered in the dark. "Nothing too distant, though the most recent past has its own risks, but back far enough that we'll find a witch to train you. First, we have to talk to Sarah about whether it can be done safely, and then we need to locate 3 items to steer us to the right time." "We?" I'd asked in surprise. "Won't I just meet you there?" "Not unless there's no alternative. I wasn't the same creature then, and I wouldn't entirely trust my past selves with you." His mouth softened in relief after I nodded in agreement. A few days ago, he'd rejected the idea of time walking. Apparently, the risks of staying put were even worse.
"What will the others do?"
His thumb traveled slowly over the veins on the back of my hand. "Miriam and Marcus will go back to Oxford. The congregation will look for you here first. It would be best if Sarah and Emily went away, at least for a little while. Would they go to Isabeau?" Matthew wondered. On the surface, it had sounded like a ridiculous idea. Sarah and Isabeau under the same roof? The more I considered it, though, the less implausible it seemed. "I don't know," I'd mused. Then a new worry had surfaced. "Marcus." I didn't fully understand the intricacies of the Knights of Lazarus, but with Matthew gone, he would have to shoulder even more responsibility.
"There's no other way," Matthew had said in the darkness, quieting me with a kiss. This was precisely the point that Em now wanted to argue.
"There must be another way," she protested.
"I tried to think of one, Emily," Matthew said apologetically.
"Where, or should I say when, are you planning on going? Diana won't exactly blend into the background, she's too tall."
Miriam looked down at her own tiny hands.
"Regardless of whether Diana could fit in, it's too dangerous," Marcus said firmly. "You might end up in the middle of a war, or an epidemic."
"Or a witch hunt."
Miriam didn't say it maliciously, but three heads swung around in indignation nonetheless.
Sarah, what do you think? Asked Matthew.
Of all the creatures in the room, she was the calmest. You'll take her to a time when she'll be with witches who will help her?
Yes.
Sarah closed her eyes for a moment, then opened them. You two aren't safe here. Juliet Durand proved that, and if you aren't safe in Madison, you aren't safe anywhere.
Thank you.
Matthew opened his mouth to say something else, and Sarah held up her hand. Don't promise me anything, she said, voice tight. You'll be careful for her sake, if not for your own.
Now all we have to worry about is the time walking.
Matthew turned businesslike. Diana will need three items from a particular time and place in order to move safely. Sarah nodded.
Do I count as a thing? He asked her.
Do you have a pulse? Of course you're not a thing. It was one of the most positive statements Sarah had ever made about vampires.
If you need old stuff to guide your way, you're welcome to these.
Marcus pulled a thin leather cord from the neck of his shirt and lifted it over his head. It was festooned with a bizarre assortment of items, including a tooth, a coin, a lump of something that shone black and gold, and a battered silver whistle. He tossed it to Matthew.
Didn't you get this off a yellow fever victim? Matthew asked, fingering the tooth.
In New Orleans, Marcus replied, the epidemic of 1819.
New Orleans is out of the question, Matthew said sharply.
I suppose so.
Marcus slid a glance my way, then returned his attention to his father. How about Paris? One of Fanny's earbobs is on there.
Matthew's fingers touched a tiny red stone set in gold filigree.
Philippe and I sent you away from Paris, and Fanny too. They called it the Terror, remember? It's no place for Diana.
The two of you fussed over me like old women. I'd been in one revolution already.
Besides, if you're looking for a safe place in the past, you'll have a hell of a time finding one, Marcus grumbled.
His face brightened. Philadelphia?
I wasn't in Philadelphia with you or in California, Matthew said hastily before his son could speak. It would be best if we head for a time and place I know.
Even if you know where we're going, Matthew, I'm not sure I can pull this off. My decision to stay clear of magic had caught up with me again.
I think you can, Sarah said bluntly. You've been doing it your whole life. When you were a baby, as a child when you played hide-and-seek with Stephen, and as an adolescent, too. Remember all those mornings we dragged you out of the woods and had to clean you up in time for school? What do you imagine you were doing then?
Certainly not time-walking, I said truthfully. The science of this still worries me. Where does this body go when I'm somewhere else?
Who knows? But don't worry, it's happened to everybody. You drive to work and don't remember how you got there. Or the whole afternoon passes and you don't have a clue what you did. Whenever something like that happens, you can bet there's a time walker nearby, explained Sarah. She was remarkably unfazed at the prospect.
Matthew sensed my apprehension and took my hand in his.
Einstein said that all physicists were aware that the distinctions between past, present, and future were only what he called a stubbornly persistent illusion. Not only did he believe in marvels and wonders, he also believed in the elasticity of time.
There was a tentative knock at the door.
I didn't hear a car, Miriam said warily, rising to her feet. It's just Sammy collecting the newspaper money.
Em slid from her chair.
We waited silently while she crossed the hall, the floorboards protesting under her feet. From the way their hands were pressed flat against the table's wooden surface, Matthew and Marcus were both ready to fly to the door, too.
Cold air swept into the dining room.
Yes?
Em asked in a puzzled voice. In an instant, Marcus and Matthew rose and joined her, accompanied by Tabitha, who was intent on supporting the leader of the pack in his important business.
Not the paper boy, Sarah said unnecessarily, looking at the empty chair next to me.
Are you Diana Bishop? Asked a deep male voice, with the familiar foreign accent of flat vowels accompanied by a slight drawl.
No, I'm her aunt, Em replied.
Is there something we can do for you?
Matthew sounded cold, though polite.
My name is Nathaniel Wilson, and this is my wife, Sophie. We were told we might find Diana Bishop here.
Who told you that? Matthew asked softly.
His mother, Agatha.
I stood, moving to the door.
His voice reminded me of the demon from Blackwell's, the fashion designer from Australia with the beautiful brown eyes. Miriam tried to bar my way into the hall, but stepped aside when she saw my expression. Marcus was not so easily dealt with. He grabbed my arm and held me in the shadows by the staircase. Nathaniel's eyes nudged gently against my face. He was in his early 20s and had familiar fair hair and chocolate-colored eyes, as well as his mother's wide mouth and fine features. Where Agatha had been compact and trim, however, he was nearly as tall as Matthew, with the broad shoulders and narrow hips of a swimmer. An enormous backpack was slung over one shoulder. "Are you Diana Bishop?" he asked. A woman's face peeped out from Nathaniel's side. It was sweet and round, with intelligent brown eyes and a dimpled chin. She was in her early 20s as well, and the gentle, insidious pressure of her glance indicated that she too was a demon. As she studied me, a long brown braid tumbled over her shoulder. "That's her," the young woman said, her soft accent betraying that she was born in the South. "She looks just like she did in my dreams." "It's all right, Matthew," I said. These two demons posed no more danger to me than did Mart or Isabeau. "So, you're the vampire," Nathaniel said, giving Matthew an appraising look. "My mother warned me about you." "You should listen to her," Matthew suggested, his voice dangerously soft. Nathaniel seemed unimpressed. "She told me you wouldn't welcome the son of a congregation member, but I'm not here on their behalf. I'm here because of Sophie." He drew his wife under his arm in a protective gesture, and she shivered and crept closer. Neither was dressed for autumn in New York. Nathaniel was wearing an old barn jacket, and Sophie had on nothing warmer than a turtleneck and a hand-knit cardigan that brushed her knees. "Are they both demons?" Matthew asked me.
"Yes," I replied, though something made me hesitate.
"Are you a vampire as well?" Nathaniel asked Marcus. Marcus gave him a wolfish grin. "Guilty."
Sophie was still nudging me with her characteristic demonic glance, but there was the faintest tingle on my skin. Her hand crept possessively around her belly. "You're pregnant," I cried.
Marcus was so surprised that he loosened his grip on me. Matthew caught me as I went by. The house, agitated by the appearance of two visitors and Matthew's sudden lunge, made its displeasure clear by banging the keeping room's doors tightly closed.
"What you feel, it's me," Sophie said, moving an inch closer to her husband. "My people were witches, but I came out wrong."
Sarah came into the hall, saw the visitors, and threw up her hands. "Here we go again. I told you demons would be showing up in Madison before long. Still, the house usually knows our business better than we do. Now that you're here, you might as well come inside out of the cold." The house groaned as if it were heartily sick of us when the demons entered. "Don't worry," I said, trying to reassure them. "The house told us you were coming, no matter what it sounds like."
"My granny's house was just the same," Sophie smiled. "She lived in the old Norman place in Seven Devils. That's where I'm from. It's officially part of North Carolina, but my dad said that nobody bothered to tell folks in town. We're kind of a nation unto ourselves."
The keeping room doors opened wide, revealing my grandmother and three or four more bishops, all of whom were watching the proceedings with interest. The boy with the berry basket waved. Sophie shyly waved back.
"Granny had ghosts, too," she said calmly.
The ghosts, combined with two unfriendly vampires and an overly expressive house, were too much for Nathaniel. "We aren't staying longer than we have to, Sophie. You came to give something to Diana. Let's get it over with and be on our way," Nathaniel said. Miriam chose that minute to step out of the shadows by the dining room, her arms crossed over her chest. Nathaniel took a step backward. "First vampires, now demons. What's next?" Sarah muttered. She turned to Sophie. "So you're about 5 months along?"
"The baby quickened last week," Sophie replied, both hands resting on her belly. "That's when Agatha told us we could find Diana. She didn't know about my family. I've been having dreams about you for months, and I don't know what Agatha saw that made her so scared."
"What dreams?" Matthew said, his voice quick. "Let's have Sophie sit down before we subject her to an inquisition." Sarah quietly took charge. "Em, can you bring us some of those cookies? Milk, too?"
Em headed toward the kitchen, where we could hear the distant clatter of glasses. "They could be my dreams, or they could be hers." Sophie gazed at her belly as Sarah led her and Nathaniel deeper into the house. She looked back over her shoulder at Matthew. "She's a witch, you see. That's probably what worried Nathaniel's mom."
All eyes dropped to the bump under Sophie's blue sweater. "The dining room," Sarah said in a tone that brooked no nonsense.
Everybody in the dining room.
Matthew held me back. There's something too convenient about us showing up right now. No mention of time walking in front of them.
They're harmless. Every instinct confirmed it.
Nobody's harmless, and that certainly goes for Agatha Wilson's son.
Tabitha, who was sitting next to Matthew, mewled in agreement. Are you two joining us, or do I have to drag you into this room? Sarah called.
We're on our way, Matthew said smoothly.
Sarah was at the head of the table. She pointed at the empty chairs to her right.
Sit.
We were facing Sophie and Nathaniel, who sat with an empty seat between them and Marcus. Matthew's son split his attention between his father and the demons. I sat between Matthew and Miriam, both of whom never took their eyes from Nathaniel. When M entered, she had a tray laden with wine, milk, bowls of berries and nuts, and an enormous plate of cookies.
God, cookies make me wish like hell I was still warm-blooded, Marcus said reverently, picking up one of the golden discs studded with chocolate and holding it to his nose. They smell so good, but they taste terrible.
Have these instead, M said, sliding him a bowl of walnuts. They're covered in vanilla and sugar. They're not cookies, but they're close.
She passed him a bottle of wine and a corkscrew, too.
Open that and pour some for your father.
Thanks, M, Marcus said around a mouthful of sticky walnuts, already pulling the cork free from the bottle. You're the best. Sarah watched intently as Sophie drank thirstily from the glass of milk and ate a cookie. When the demon reached for her second, my aunt turned to Nathaniel.
Now, where's your car?
Given all that had happened, it was an odd opening question.
We came on foot.
Nathaniel hadn't touched anything M put in front of him.
From where?
Marcus asked incredulously, handing Matthew a glass of wine. He'd seen enough of the surrounding countryside to know that there was nothing within walking distance.
We rode with a friend from Durham to Washington, Sophie explained. Then we caught a train from D.C. to New York. I don't like the city much.
We caught the train to Albany and then went on to Syracuse. The bus took us to Casanova.
Nathaniel put a warning hand on Sophie's arm.
He doesn't want me to tell you that we caught a ride from a stranger, Sophie confided with a smile. The lady knew where the house was. Her kids love coming here on Halloween because you're real witches.
Sophie took another sip of milk.
Not that we needed the directions. There's a lot of energy in this house. We couldn't have missed it.
Is there a reason you took such an indirect route? Matthew asked Nathaniel.
Somebody followed us as far as New York, but Sophie and I got back on the train for Washington and they lost interest.
Nathaniel bristled.
Then we got off the train in New Jersey and went back to the city. The man in the station said tourists get confused all the time about which way the train is going. They didn't even charge us, did they, Nathaniel?
Sophie looked pleased at the warm reception they'd received from Amtrak.
Matthew continued with his interrogation of Nathaniel. Where are you staying?
They're staying here.
M's voice had a sharp edge. They don't have a car, and the house made room for them. Besides, Sophie needs to talk to Diana.
I'd like that. Agatha said you'd be able to help. Something about a book for the baby?
Sophie said softly.
Marcus's eyes darted to the page from Ashmole 782, the edge of which was peeking from underneath the chart laying out the Knights of Lazarus's chain of command. He hastily drew the papers into a pile, moving an innocuous-looking set of DNA results to the top.
What book, Sophie? I asked. We didn't tell Agatha my people were witches. I didn't even tell Nathaniel, not until he came home to meet my dad. We'd been together for almost 4 years, and my dad was sick and losing control over his magic. I didn't want Nathaniel spooked. Anyway, when we got married, we thought it was best not to cause a fuss. Agatha was on the congregation by then, and was always talking about the segregation rules and what happened when folks broke 'em.
Sophie shook her head.
It never made any sense to me.
The book? I repeated, gently trying to steer the conversation.
Oh.
Sophie's forehead creased with concentration and she fell silent.
My mother is thrilled about the baby. She said it's going to be the best-dressed child the world has ever seen.
Nathaniel smiled tenderly at his wife.
Then the dream started. Sophie felt trouble was coming. She has strong premonitions for a demon, just like my mother. In September she started seeing Diana's face and hearing a name. Sophie said people want something from you.
Matthew's fingers touched the small of my back where Satu's scar dipped down.
Show them her face, Jug, Nathaniel. It's just a picture. I wanted to bring it, but he said we couldn't carry a gallon jug from Durham to New York.
Her husband obediently took out his phone and pulled up a picture on the screen. Nathaniel handed the phone to Sarah, who gasped.
I'm a potter, like my mama and her mother. Granny used witch fire in her kiln, but I just do it the ordinary way. All of the faces from my dreams